recording.
Hi, this is Paul Hurt and Jennifer Sweeney of Arizona State University, speaking with Mike Yates of the Hopi Cultural Preservation Office and Northern Arizona University. It's September 8th, 2018, and we're at NAU. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Sure, no problem.
Could you start out by telling us your full name, the positions that you've held in the Adaptive Management Program, and the years that you were involved in it?
Okay. Well, my name's Michael Yates, and I guess I got involved in the program before there was an adaptive management program. I started back in 1991 with the original Glen Canyon Environmental Studies, which is the first EIS that led up to the adaptive management program, what created it. And so, you know, at the beginning, I was doing research for the Hopi. I got hired in 1991 for the, you know, with the Hopi tribe, and it was specifically for at that time the GCES program. And so I was primarily doing the research end of the Hopi involvement, although I was also involved in a lot of the cooperators meetings for the development of the EIS, and was on the writing team for the original EIS, the 95-96 EIS. But a lot of what I was doing was research in the canyon for both the ethno-history of the Hopi tribe down there in conjunction with, like, T.J. Ferguson, who the tribe hired as a consultant. I was doing archaeological surveys of the Little Colorado River, which was going to be the focus of a lot of the fish research, the endangered fish work, and it's culturally a very important place for the Hopi, so they were concerned that we made sure we documented what areas were culturally important there so they wouldn't be impacted by the work. And then I also was working some with the Park Service doing archaeological work down there.
Were you working with Jan Balsam on that big survey? They had a whole series of trips that did a comprehensive survey of the river?
I wasn't working on the park's actual survey. Mm-hmm. We kind of overlap, but the survey I did in the Little Colorado River was the parallel to what the park was doing. Uh-huh. So it was to make sure that stretch also had a comprehensive archaeological and cultural inventory to go along with the parks for the whole river corridor.
So in the years you were doing that was 1991, 92, 93?
Yeah, basic, you know, the research to essentially record information for the Hopis to support the positions in the original EIS were from essentially 1991 to 1995, more or less. I mean, it was ongoing. It's continued ever since. But that was the primary focus, was to be able to document stuff for the cultural sections in the EIS. And then, you know, as part of that, as involved on the writing teams for it to make sure the Hopi stuff got integrated correctly. Mm-hmm. And parallel with that, and actually a little earlier than the completion of the EIS, was the development of the Section 106 Cultural Resources Compliance for the National Historic Preservation Act. Mm-hmm. And that actually was completed in 1994, I believe. And so we were writing the programmatic agreement at the same time for addressing the cultural resources issues.
So let me ask you, the work that was done to comply with the Historic Preservation Act, I guess, was that foundational then to the EIS, or were those separate documents?
They were separate documents, and I think some of the confusion that we're in still with the different roles and compliance responsibilities for Section 106 and for the broader NEPA date back to that time period, because when the dam was constructed, there was cultural resources work upstream, but never downstream.
Right.
And so the first swipe we took at developing a cultural resources compliance program for downstream was basically independent of the EIS. I mean, it triggered it all off, but it was specifically for the operations of the dam, mm-hmm. which sort of was what the EIS was, but not entirely. Normally, you would do the EIS and then either during the development of it or following it, do the compliance for whatever the selected alternative was. Mm-hmm. We just did it on the overall operations of the dam. Uh-huh. And so it was completed before the EIS was, but it also meant that the cultural program was never as well integrated into the overall, what became the AMP program. Mm-hmm. Whereas parallel to that, the endangered species work, primarily the fish, was developed part and parcel with the EIS, and so a lot of the activities that came out of the EIS were directly aimed at the ESA, you know, compliance. Uh-huh. So we ended up with kind of two parallel programs in a sense, where the when NEPA was done, the ESA stuff became essentially the adaptive management program, whereas the cultural, we were never sure how it fit in, and we're still not entirely sure. The cultural people, I think, know how it fits in, but the rest of the program doesn't necessarily. So that was one of those legacies out of the original development that they, you know, part of the concern at the time, and part of the reason why the Grand Canyon Protection Act ended up being written was there wasn't a lot of, I guess, assurance that we'd ever complete the EIS. And so the thought was, well, even if the EIS never gets completed, we want to make sure we do the Section 106 cultural compliance. And so that also is why it's kind of on a separate path that, you know, when the original EIS was started back in 89, I think is when correct. It actually
got launched.
Yeah. You know, there was no, the politics were such it wasn't clear it would ever be completed.
So I think Lee Kuan Wasiuma mentioned that there was a chapter on the cultural resources for each of the affected tribes integrated into the record of decision in 1996. Did the cultural resource inventory work, the ethnohistory work, and the archaeological survey work that you all were working on earlier, did that get integrated into that record of decision? Or is it still remaining a sort of a parallel path with some integration but not full?
I would say some. Essentially, the tribes that were involved, you know, I think one of the really progressive, innovative things with the original EIS was how integral the tribes were brought into the process, and I think Dave Wagner had a lot to do with that. But it meant that rather than us just generating a report that then someone else took and tried to put in the EIS, we were able to do our own research to document stuff, and most of the tribes kept the really detailed report confidential. There's a lot of esoteric knowledge and things because, you know, the ties to the canyon are more than just archaeology. They're, you know, cover a lot of the, at least for Hopi, the really significant values that cause Hopi to be what Hopi is now, you know, in the ceremonial and clan history and all of that. And so we were able to document that, but then we also were able to put in the EIS the stuff that would support our position based on that research, but was at a level that was appropriate for other people to see. And so that's why we were part of the writing team, was to actually do it ourselves. So in that sense, it did get integrated. The specific cultural surveys were primarily done for the 106 portion of it. And so while that information certainly fed into the analysis that went on in the EIS for changing the operations, you know, it wasn't, I guess, duplicated or regurgitated just in that. And certainly the record of decision reflected the views and positions that came out of all the cultural resources surveys and work.
Can I ask you, who funded that? So when you say Section 106 compliance work, you're referring to the National Historic Preservation
Right.
Act?
All right. Yes.
Section 106. Who funded Yeah. that early work before there was an adaptive management program and dedicated funds from hydropower revenues? Where'd that money come from?
It was Bureau of Reclamation.
Yeah.
And I think even then it was hydropower. Okay. It's my understanding. I'm trying to remember. But it was, I mean, it was part and parcel of doing the whole EIS. Mm-hmm. But it was, because it's a separate law, it was also on its own path. But mm-hmm. without the EIS research going on, it wouldn't have been done.
Somebody else has told us before that most of what really gets a lot of attention in the adaptive management program are those things that have the extra leverage of a legal mandate, like the Endangered Species Act. And you just mentioned mm-hmm. earlier that that really almost drove the program at the beginning, because right. the ESA was something you couldn't ignore. Do you feel the same way about the National Historic Preservation Act, that without that and the Section 106 compliance, that it might have been ignored much more than it was?
Yeah, probably. And even, you know, there's essentially three laws that kind of are driving the program. Uh-huh. You know, the Grand Canyon Protection Act, ESA, and NHPA. I mean, those are the ones that need to be complied with for the operations. I mean, certainly there's the whole body of law, the river stuff that constrains everything.
Right.
But as far as what is kind of ongoing compliance, those are the three.
Those are the three.
And unfortunately, I don't think that they've all been, well, the Grand Canyon Protection Act is kind of just nebulous. I mean, I don't know how you comply with that other than do something. But but the other two, the Endangered Species Act is certainly the bigger hammer in the program. For a number of reasons, I think. I mean, the National Historic Preservation Act is pretty rarely used for lawsuits or those kind of things. It's just people rarely sue under it. Whereas under ESA, people get sued all the time.
Yeah.
And so I think that's for the Bureau of Reclamation, that's probably a bigger threat. Uh-huh. So they want to make sure. But I think actually probably the more important driver for why there's so much fish work, which is mostly driven by ESA, mm-hmm. as opposed to just generic research on fish, is because it's the one resource that pretty much all the basin states, and particularly the upper basin, have an interest in seeing progress, because there's a large number of development projects in the upper basin, water development, that rely on the population of chub down here being healthy, essentially. It's part of their compliance. And so whenever you get to funding, ESA is, and stuff that helps the chub is viewed as important by virtually all the stakeholders.
Interesting.
Cultural resources, if we go totally out of compliance, it really doesn't affect the upper basin or much of the lower basin. Uh-huh. It's just a Bureau of Reclamation issue. So that also, I think, has driven a little bit how the budgeting has happened, both, you know, since the Record of Decision and since the new ROD, too, the LTEMP.
Uh-huh. You got me thinking about the difference between the Endangered Species Act and the National Historic Preservation Act now. And I'm wondering, you know, in the Endangered Species Act, it requires a bunch of research right up front, and then you have to come up with a biological opinion about the endangerment of whatever it mm-hmm. was you were researching. And if it's found to be threatened or endangered, then you're required to do something to either recover the species or certainly to not add any additional jeopardy. Is there anything like that in the National Historic Preservation Act? It certainly funds site surveys, but then is that kind of where it stops?
And no, it's actually very parallel. I mean, essentially, what NHPA is saying is that when a federal agency does something, whether directly or through funding or permitting or whatever, they need to consider their potential effect on historic properties. And so that usually is what triggers the surveys and identification of what properties are out there. And then you determine what the potential effect to them might be. And if there is an adverse effect, you need to develop ways to mitigate that effect if possible. The place where it somewhat differs, although I'm not an expert on ESA to the point of knowing what latitude the lead agency has, but it's the one section 106 is a process, and you can go through it and at the end come out and say, we've identified everything, we know we're having an adverse effect, oh well, we're moving forward. Generally, that isn't the case. I mean, enough players will come in and say, you should be doing something, either modifying the project or, you know, traditionally for archaeological sites, you excavate, that kind of thing. And so that's just viewed as part of doing business. But it's within the purview of the lead agency to do nothing if they go through the whole process. Because if you're challenged, it's all you need to do is document you went through the process.
That sounds like the National Environmental Policy Act to me. It's a procedural law. It says you have to do the assessment, but it doesn't tell you what decisions you have to take.
You know, and generally, people try to minimize their impact. With ESA, it's kind of the same thing. You go through and you develop the conservation measures, and they probably do. Well, I don't know, you know, if you decide you're not going to do anything, I don't know what latitude the agency then has. I mean, can they say, we've decided we just can't preserve the species, we're not going to do what the Fish and Wildlife says?
No,
you know, they'll probably
be
challenged.
Yeah.
And I know there's, what do they call it, the God Squad or whatever, that can decide they're not going to try to save a species.
Right.
You know, and that's where if an agency isn't doing what it says or what people think it should, you know, they tend to get sued.
But you say not many people sue on the National Historic Preservation.
No, it's pretty rare. And so that, you know, in a sense, there's not as much of a big hammer hanging over if you don't do it. You know, and again, though, generally, when you go through NHPA, when you get to the point where you say there's an adverse effect, then you put together either a memorandum of agreement or a programmatic agreement that stipulates what you're going to do to mitigate those impacts. And so again, if you have a bunch of stipulations that everyone agrees to and you don't follow them, then probably you're legally in jeopardy in the same way as if there's a bunch of conservation measures for endangered species and you don't follow through on them. So, you know, there is still that.
Some parallel.
So, you know, if an agency agrees to do something and doesn't, I think they can't then just ignore it. They're legally binding.
Well, let me ask you, just following up on that then, what's your judgment about how well the Adaptive Management Program has accommodated, addressed the concerns and requests of the cultural resource professionals like yourself and others?
I mean, throughout the whole program, it certainly gets, you know, a fair amount of attention and things. Monetarily, it's definitely not anywhere near what the biological or sediment programs are, although some of the sediment is certainly related to the cultural resource issues. And again, I think some of that is due to just the legacy of how the program developed, slightly independent, and what it's meant is that you know, in the budgeting process, there's kind of the overall adaptive management budget, but it's broken down between what the Bureau of Reclamation administers, mostly for their compliance stuff, and then the broader Grand Canyon Monitoring and Research Center budget for the science. And the cultural resources work, by and large, has been viewed as synonymous with just NHPA compliance. And beyond that, there's been a fairly limited, I guess, non-compliance cultural resources program. It's also meant that tribal interests tend to be subsumed under cultural resources. You know, in the beginning, probably because, you know, that is kind of where the tribes were involved most, as the program developed, but also it's, in a way, I think, easier for the rest of AMP to go, the Bureau's dealing with the tribes and cultural, because they're the same thing. So in that sense, it hasn't nearly been as well integrated into the broader adaptive management program and the broader science. You know, certainly there's issues with how do you integrate the tribal knowledge value system into a Western science program, but I think it also has not been done very well. You know, it's one of those hard ones to address, and you know, there's both issues of not knowing how to do it, but also just, like I said, some of the legacy issues of how the program developed and how, you know, got handed off to different people. You know, it's, again, is the legacy of, in the GCS days, the tribes kind of came up with what they wanted to do and provided a budget to the Bureau of Reclamation. And as the research center came into being, you know, initially that was going to be essentially a contract administrative center, and it contract all the science out, and they would develop RFPs and that kind of thing. For most of the tribal work, they couldn't really develop RFPs because the tribe essentially had to do it, and then they were the only ones who could do the research because the tribes knew what they needed. They needed, you know, tribal elders, specialists with traditional knowledge to be able to do the research. Right. So it became essentially the cultural program at the center was a way to facilitate getting the tribes the money to do the research. And so there was just never a cultural program separate from the tribal work that the center did much of. I mean, they've done certainly stuff, pieces. And then for the archaeology side of it, the Park Service has always done that. And again, when they, you know, they did the original survey, there wasn't a center at the time, but the Park Service did that work just like most of the other players did their own work in their own specialties. The tribes each did it. Game and Fish did fish work, Fish and Wildlife did their own thing, but it's all funded out of one pot. When the center was kind of taken over to become the coordinating role, the cultural stuff, the park retained it. The fish stuff became part and parcel of what GCMRC's essentially science was in the sediment. And they just weren't sure how to deal with tribal stuff. And so we've always been a little on the periphery, both tribal and cultural in the larger sense. And there was, you know, certainly still are, I think, to some extent, some turf wars between different agencies and that kind of thing. So, you know, that's kind of led to where we are now, which is still somewhat on the outside looking in. And the GCMRC.
Do you think that could be remedied?
I think so.
What would it look like? Can you paint us a picture of what it would look like if it was working better?
I think, you know, one of the big needs, essentially, is a unified vision of what the program is. and within that some of the cultural resource stuff, and then buy-in from all the different players about how to achieve that, essentially. And so, you know, with the park always doing the archaeology monitoring, you know, they don't want an outside agency to be doing that, I don't think. You know, they view that as something that they do. That's their management responsibility. But it also means that they decide kind of what they're doing, the protocols, the methodologies, those kind of things. And with the programmatic agreements, you know, the other participants in the cultural review things and stuff, certainly, but it's driven more by the park, I think, than the broader adaptive management program. You know, and again, the signatories to the PA really are the ones who are interested in the cultural resources. And so I think the rest of the adaptive management program stakeholders don't really want to get involved in that. Whereas with the endangered fish work, like I said, they have a vested interest, so they're willing to push things they see will help recover the fish. For the tribal stuff, you know, you have another federal agency, they're not going to tell the tribe what they think the tribe should be doing as far as their own research, so that ends up somewhat outside of the program. You know, we've tried different things through time. Certainly, I think the best approach has been just a lot of day-to-day involvement, people all working together to come to agreement on some of it. And I mean, I think the adaptive management program has been very good at that, having lots of buy-in from lots of different stakeholders. But just the process of how you design research and review it and stuff, it makes it hard when some of the participants have to develop it on their own and then feed it into the program. Mm-hmm. So that didn't really answer your question, but I mean, I think we're kind of doing it as best we can. I think we, you know, the program has to recognize the independence of the different agencies to some extent, and recognize that they have their own mandates that may dictate how much of a lead role they take in developing some of the stuff. I mean, certainly, you know, with the endangered species stuff, Fish and Wildlife pretty much unilaterally says these are what you need to do to be in compliance. The difference has been that then, since they're not the landowner, they're willing to let others do that actual, whether it's management or research or monitoring. Mm-hmm. So there's other players that are involved in doing that. For the cultural resources, because the resources are a park resource, it's harder from a management perspective and administratively for the park to yield to some outside groups going, this is the way we're going to manage the cultural resources. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the way we've tried to go about it in the past is put together a historic preservation plan that basically says this is what we want to manage for, how we want to go about doing it.
And we, then, when you say we, mean the Hopi tribe, for example, in your case?
Yeah, as one of them, the signatories to the programmatic agreement.
Okay.
Both the first one and the one we're working on now. So it's kind of the groups that have an identified role in cultural resource management. Mm-hmm. Coming up as a group with how we see the management going forward in the future. The question then becomes, who's actually going to do that work? And, you know, some of that gets back into funding.
Right.
And, you know, the dam is, I don't want to say viewed as a large cash register, but it has been a solid source of funding outside the normal politics that goes on with, you know, the normal funding cycle. And mm-hmm. So, you know, people see that as a way to help fund their agencies to do work.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, and so the Park Service gets funding for monitoring the cultural resources or the archaeological sites. Game and Fish gets some funding for fish monitoring. Fish and Wildlife does some too. I mean, everyone involved benefits from the program too.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it's not an easy one. I mean, like I said, when they originally established the center, it's supposed to be a small enterprise that basically just wrote RFPs and contracted work out.
That's a Grand Canyon Monitoring and
right.
Research Center.
Uh-huh.
And then they started doing their own research.
They started, and part of it was because, you know, coming out of GCMRC, a lot of the people who ultimately were at the beginning of the Grand Canyon Monitoring and Research Center were doing the research.
Mm-hmm.
And to keep those people on, scientists are interested in doing research. So mm-hmm. they started out, you know, continuing those programs. And then slowly those programs, you know, it switched from being a contract center to a pure science center that does most of the science. Now, certainly there's still a lot of partners who do stuff. But, yeah, I mean, it's become a pretty big science program.
Uh-huh. We have spoken to at least one other person who was a little bit disappointed in that change because there was a lot of money for a lot of research that supported a lot of professional researchers that were either independent or had their own consulting organization or worked at a university, and a lot of that money that supported that kind of work dried up when it got sort of concentrated in the GCMRC. Do you see it that way or not?
Well, certainly from the tribal side, it really didn't change things mm-hmm. in the sense of being able to get funding, is, you know, since the tribes were the only ones that could do the work, you know, whether
right.
it went through the center or not, it still came to us. I mean,
right.
certainly the funding has never been what we thought was adequate, but
mm-hmm.
I think probably everyone would say that, no matter what. I think one of the things that it's led to, and this gets a little back to, you know, how could you make it work better, be more integrated,
uh-huh.
is since the center develops the budget and work plan, they, you know, it's their own scientists who are developing a lot of that work. I mean, they get certainly guidance from Twig and Amwig, but really the actual development of what research is going to happen to address these bigger questions is driven by the center.
Uh-huh.
And because it's the scientists who may be doing the work who are developing it, mm-hmm. you know, whether that goes down some pet project sort of roads or not. I mean, you know, certainly there's checks on the system, and there's lots of projects that get dropped that may be interesting research, but once it reaches Twig and Amway, it's like, well, you know, this is either straying too far or the budget's limited and these are much higher priority sort of things. But I don't know whether if the center had stayed mostly as a contracting sort of entity, if it would have been better at developing research monitoring programs that would be more integrated but also more focused, because others would be bidding on it then, you know, and I don't know how
instead
that would
instead of self-dealing.
Yeah.
And
I mean, I certainly don't want to say that they're, you know, they're milking the system or anything. But, yeah, I mean, the researchers are interested in lots of stuff down there, and they do really good research. But, you know, it's certainly one of those areas where it can bring in the different personal interests and emphasis
right.
to different parts of the program.
One of our interviewees told us that there were occasionally research programs funded and implemented by GCMRC that not everybody in AMWIC thought were of the highest value. And when you have a limited pot of research funding, you want to sort of fund the programs that are going to provide the greatest value, added value. Mm-hmm. And this particular interviewee was saying that just because there were researchers at GCMRC committed to this particular line of research, mm-hmm. that it kept getting funded, even though a majority of people on AMWIG were questioning the value of continuing to put money down that pathway. Did you experience anything like that?
Well, certainly, yeah. I mean, there's, you know, research that different stakeholders question. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I think there are enough checks and balances in the mm-hmm. system with all the review that goes on of what the proposed programs are that I don't think too much gets through. I mean, uh-huh. it is definitely, you know, funding limited. There was a funding limit put on it.
Right.
You know, when the ROD was done, the original ROD. And so, you know, I think in that sense, there's enough oversight that it's not like it can just run amok and do right. whatever they want.
So it's working pretty well.
So I think it works pretty well. I guess, you know, my, you know, the comment about whether or not it's always the best research that could be done for some bigger picture, you know, again, that's because most of those research questions are being developed internally. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to be driven by people's interests to some extent,
sure,
you
sure.
know, what they choose to focus on and those kind of things. So, yeah, it's relevant, but yeah. is it, if you had a totally outside group come in and go, okay, we're going, this is what we think should be done. And even that, I mean, the program's been good about getting those kind of reviews, the protocol of uh-huh. evaluation panel, the PEP panels, those kind of things, where you bring outside people in and go, mm-hmm. this is what we're trying to achieve, this is what we're doing. Is this the best way to go about it? Should we change? So there has been a lot of that. I mean, you know, I think this has been one of the better programs that I know of out there as far as trying to address a complex system with mm-hmm. a very diverse suite of stakeholders and interests.
In the face of great uncertainty.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know, and some of the issues, you know, in one sense, all the hard issues were resolved in the first EIS.
Yeah.
It's the hard ones that couldn't get resolved there that drive adaptive management. And some of the issues, which gets back to the question of, you know, is the research that's being done something that everyone agrees to or not, is just what is the scope of the program? Are we, you know, a lot of people are insisting it's only things that are affected by the day-to-day operations of the dam. For cultural, you know, at least from my perspective, part of the operation of the dam is the fact that there is a dam. Mm-hmm. But other stakeholders have said, no, it's just the daily up and down is all we're looking at. And that changes then what you think should be studied or not and what's in or out of the program.
In a sense, you're saying, some people are saying, the existence of the dam should be off the table.
Right. Oh, they've explicitly said that. It's not the existence, it's the operation. But, you know, a large majority of the program is really the existence. I mean, the fact that there's no sediment, it's cold, clear water, which drives all the fish stuff, you know, that's an existence of the dam. That isn't the daily operations. You can't do much with daily operations to affect those parameters. Mm-hmm. So a large part of the program isn't really looking at existence, but because stakeholders see value in addressing the endangered fish, we have people working, you know, 12 miles up the Little Colorado River. That's not affected by the daily operations of the dam. But in cultural, they get upset if we go above 45,000 CFS, even though there's definitely documented indirect effects up there.
Sure.
So, you know, some of it's politics, mm-hmm. what people think should or shouldn't be done.
But generally, you're saying the safeguards in place, the peer review and the collaborative process and the multi-stakeholder, that all, you know, nothing's perfect and things are working right. about as well as they could be. And you're satisfied that, you know.
Yeah.
That's great.
No, I think, you know, by and large, it's a very good program. And, you know, I think one of the strongest aspects of the program is that all the stakeholders are still at the table, willing to talk to each other after all these years. I mean, you know, bring it up to the present day when the issues of potentially not having funding for FY19 came to a head. Mm-hmm. When you look at the groups that were collaborating to lobby Congress for legislation, it's like they're on diametrically opposed ends of what you would think would be cooperating, but they are.
All
you know, and
together.
By and large, you know, a lot of the people in the program have been involved for so long that everyone's friendly. I mean, everyone knows everyone, and so it's very collegial, and you know, even if we don't agree on everything, we're willing to sit down and have a beer afterwards and stuff. So, I mean, that has been a real benefit of the program. And that gets to, I think, that collaborative aspect that, you know, if it becomes a program that looks like it's only driven by one entity with just kind of input that may or may not go anywhere from everyone, there's just a lot more distrust. Whereas if everyone feels like they have a say, and even if you don't get your way, you get that buy-in, I think, and people understand what's going on, which has been a real benefit.
In your experience, is that unusual? You know, the sort of multi-stakeholder level playing field, everybody negotiating together without one player dominating, is that a pretty unusual situation in natural resource management and historic preservation?
It seems like it. Certainly, historically, it is. Uh-huh. I mean, it's gotten better through time. People realize it's better to, or a lot of agencies have realized it's better to have discussions up front and keep people in the loop than to just essentially check the boxes of what they have to do and not put any emphasis on, you know, for the tribal stuff, it's
consultation.
You know, the consultation. And there's a difference between the legal consultation and actual, you know, collaborative consultation where you discuss things. And, you know, one of the things that this program, I think, got right really early on, and is probably accidental, but when we were putting the first programmatic agreement together for the Section 106 compliance, all the different parties were writing that PA, and up until that time, PAs tended to be put together by a lead agency, and then you put a few, you know, whereas clauses and stipulations in from other people after they review it and then sign off on it. This one we developed as a group, and partially that was because it was after the National Historic Preservation Act had been amended to recognize traditional cultural properties as historic properties, but before the regs had been developed, so no one actually knew how to deal with them. Mm-hmm. And it made sense that the tribes would probably have as good of idea of how to address that. And so the PA that came out really did what later became in the regs for how to implement the National Historic Preservation Act. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that, and then having essentially any of the stakeholders who wanted to be involved in actually drafting the EIS, you know, all working together, we'd go on retreats and things and actually draft sections of it. It wasn't just a lead agency doing it and then sending it out for review and comment. So, you know, the program came out of, I think, a very collaborative place to start with.
I'm wondering now if you think that the example of the adaptive management program had influence beyond the program itself, had influence on how federal agencies worked with stakeholders and tribes. Do you think, you know, having to collaborate like that, you know, written into the Grand Canyon Protection Act and the Record of Decision and all of that, that provided a different example of how to do consultation and how to collaborate with stakeholders that has had impact beyond the adaptive management program?
Maybe. Yeah, it's hard to know. I mean, certainly from a tribal side, you know, it since we were let in the door in that process, we were probably more insistent in other places, going, wait, we want to be more involved in this. We don't want to just review and comment. We want to actually help with some of the upfront decision making. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly tribes have been allowed to provide some of the traditional cultural information and stuff to incorporate into it, but you know, in the original EIS, we were involved in helping develop different alternatives and, you know, the whole nine yards. And so in that sense, I think it probably gave us an idea of what we could do in a collaborative process. You know, from a federal agency side, I don't know whether they thought it's good or bad, because you know, it certainly means more work up front. It doesn't go as quick. And you know, some agencies I'm sure prefer the old way, where they can sit in the room and do it themselves and send it out and not have to have quite as much involvement. And the most recent EIS, I think, did go back a little towards the old, that older model, in the LTAMP one, in that it was the two lead agencies that did the majority of coming up with, you know, what would be done. Certainly there was still an open process for the alternative development, and stakeholders were involved, but as far as the actual writing and stuff, you know, most of that was done by VOR or their contractors, which might be fine. Writing them is a lot of work. You know, but the tribes were still allowed to write their own sections for the affected environment and stuff. So, you know, I think there is that legacy.
Let's talk about change over time a little bit. I'm thinking now, you've been personally involved in this for 27 years.
Almost 28 more, now.
Yeah, we're talking more than a quarter of a century.
Yeah. Most of my life, I think.
Professional life.
Yeah.
Can you sort of reflect on the changes that you've seen in the program, or the relationships, or the kind of research that's been done? What kinds of changes over that 27, 28 years have you seen?
Well, I mean, certainly the biggest is it's just become a much bigger program. I mean, when it originally started, everyone knew everyone and was probably involved in the research at the very beginning. And yeah, I mean, GCMRC has grown. I mean, I go in there now and I don't recognize very many people, and there's, you know, lots of students and interns and that kind of thing that are involved.
Nice.
You know, it's I think the fundamental kind of research that's going on is still pretty much the same. You know, it's reached that point where we definitely are cycling back through issues that in the past never got completed and still need to be.
Like, for example?
I was trying to think some of the things that I saw as, you know, the biggest, not changes per se, but things that have not happened. You know, and one of the things that fundamentally shifted between when the original EIS was started and the record of decision was that it was coming out of the high flows in the 1980s, the mid-80s, and so one of the driving factors was to not have the dam have unexpected spills. So a lot of emphasis was placed on making sure that you didn't essentially fill it and spill, because that was one of the most damaging things that people had seen down there, and really triggered a lot of the erosion that people were seeing at archaeological sites and other things. By the time we got to the record of decision, is the opposite. We were looking at, well, still not having unplanned spills, but actually having floods, because people realized, I think, that too much stability wasn't good either for that system. You know, there was a lot of debate about having seasonally adjusted steady flows and whether that'd be best for fish and those kind of things. So, you know, there was a big shift, and now a lot of the experimentation is surrounding having higher than normal flows out of the dam. So that was one that kind of shifted. I think what other things have changed? Certainly for the fish work, we've learned an awful lot. We still don't seem to know what fundamentally ends up driving the native fish populations. Early on, water temperature was viewed to be one of the big issues, although at that time, one of the earliest meetings I went to was called the Aquatic Coordination Team, which was the predecessor of all the fish work stuff. And Chuck Minkley said that, he thought actually the cold water was probably the only thing that potentially saved a lot of the native fish, because it so disadvantaged everything that neither the really cold water exotics could spread quickly because it was too cold at the dam, and the warm water, which up until the dam was completed were actually the dominant fish in the system, catfish and carp and those kind of things, essentially it just kind of put a hold on everything. It didn't benefit any of the fish. So water temperature was one of the big issues. And somewhere along the line, rainbow trout became the big species that was decimating the chub primarily. And
predation was the
predation, then maybe competition. So we shifted to that for a long time, and now I think we're shifting back, because the tribes, I saw that as one of the areas where the tribes maybe actually had a pretty big role in not necessarily changing perceptions, but stopping some of the management, because the idea that you go in and kill a lot of the trout, the tribes didn't find very tasteful. They thought that was inappropriate and weren't necessarily convinced by the science at the time that trout were in fact causing the population level declines. And so I think now we're looking more at food base and temperature again is maybe being what some of the limiting issues are, because the trout have gone up in numbers at the same time as chub have. Now the whole Western Canyon is dominated by native fish again, and we're not quite sure why. We didn't do anything specifically other than water
in
temperature.
In the Western Canyon?
Western
Canyon. Way downstream.
Huh. Basically below the LCR at this point. It's back to being a native fishery.
Wow.
Which is kind of nice to hear. Mostly the suckers, but they're getting wild spawn chub down there too, that aren't spawning in the LCR.
What's the LCR?
The Little Colorado River. So, I think that's an area where there's definitely been significant knowledge and changes in perception. Some of the food-based stuff, I think, we've learned a lot lately and learned what we don't know.
Fish food, you mean?
Primarily. An area that early on I think there was more work that has now been lost is the whole terrestrial riparian zone. And that's an area that Hopi and I believe some of the other tribes tend to want more focus on. And for a while we were getting more. There was a lot more work going on in that zone on both vegetation, but birds, reptiles, amphibians, insects, kind of a more ecosystem look at it.
Why do you think that's not getting the attention that it used to and that it ought to?
I think primarily funding. Again, it's not a resource that affects a lot of the stakeholders. If it changes one way or another, it doesn't make much difference to a lot of the stakeholders. It's also that we don't know what we want. I mean, prior to the LTEMP EIS, you know, one of the big pushes was to develop desired future conditions. And that was to kind of lay out what was agreed to as how we wanted to see things in the future. And most of the resources, there isn't a lot of guidance or agreement on, partially because they're not used, in a sense. I mean, kind of a Western concept, but, you know, if you don't use it for something, you really don't have a management need for it. And so...
doesn't become a priority.
Right. And so for a lot of the riparian zone, you know, their natural resources, the park has some desired future for it, but even those are very nebulous. I mean, it's, you know, to maintain natural processes and support native over non-native, but that's an artificial zone essentially through there anyway. I mean, pre-dam, most of the riparian zone was sand. You know, certainly it's the patches of things. So it's a new zone. And
because since 1963, when the dam gates closed, sediment has been coming, and so the sand that was there has eroded away for the most
well,
part?
Well, it hasn't entirely eroded away, but it's becoming vegetated. Stuff that would have been scoured every spring during the high flows isn't. And so that zone has allowed lots of things, both native and non-native, to move into it that weren't there in any numbers pre-dam. Well, you know, the park didn't really have any targeted management for that zone beyond some of the recreation stuff. But if it's, you know, non-native, they really don't want it in there. So that's a management. Tamarisk, camelthorn, some of those kind of species. But on the other hand, there's a lot of natives that are probably equally, if not more, detrimental to recreation than the non-natives are. You know, you get the arrowweed thickets down there, and potentially the way the dam is operated is driving that system towards very clonal species. And so you may see an awful lot of arrowweed and Phragmites through the corridor and nothing else. You know, is that good or bad? I don't know.
And those are two native species,
right,
but not necessarily desirable, you're saying.
They may or may
or
not
natural.
Be. But no one, you know, that's a hard thing to decide.
Right.
You know, it'd be one thing if you were logging them or something or harvesting them, then you go, yeah. And so what's happened is, you know, for the cultural resources, archaeological sites primarily, there's a law that kind of tells you what you need to manage for. For the endangered species, we've got a law that tells us what we need to manage for. Our desired future conditions are predetermined, so that makes it easy. For, you know, sediment, a lot of its condition is a foundation for other things. So depending what those other things are, then you can kind of back into how much sediment you might want or where, those kind of things. You know, water, power, that's also driven by a lot of the laws. But you know, vegetation, it's one of those things where it's hard to know what you want down there, and different people want different things. You know, a lot of the discussion in the past has been, are we looking for a pre-dam environment or some kind of post-dam thing? If it's post-dam, what's it driven by? Is it driven by recreation? I mean, right now in the LTEMP, some of the vegetation management is specifically targeted to try to open up camping area. We're kind of reaching, you know, maybe an equilibrium on how much sand can be stored and where. The stuff that is gone is gone. And with some of the high flows and those kind of things, we may be reaching an equilibrium in places. But we're losing a lot of that area to vegetation now. And the flows are no longer high enough to remove it. You know, during the pre-original EIS period, you had the high fluctuating flows, and so you actually had a pretty big scour zone with a lot of sand. Just by virtue of having those flows. But the other thing that happened is when the EIS was started, you still saw a pretty strong signal from those really high flows in the mid-80s. I mean, the 1983 flood sand was still up there and everywhere. A lot of the beaches that are no longer even possible to camp on, I remember as big open sand beaches at the time, just because the vegetation hadn't encroached. The flows in the 80s were high enough to truly scour things. The first high flow, experimental high flow that we did in 96 scoured some stuff, but not to the point that it didn't reestablish within, you know, 3 to 5 years. It came back pretty quick. I mean, one of the marshes, Quaggan Marsh, I remember, it was an open sand dune right after the high flow. It was enough to actually devegetate it more or less, but enough was left that in a few years it's a jungle. And yeah, so, you know, some of that we're just seeing probably still the successional changes from when the dam was first put in place, and then flows got stabilized back in the early 90s. And where that goes, I don't know. You know, the other thing that I've seen is the removal of a lot of the big willows. Because again, when the flows stabilize, I think the beaver population has increased. Oh. And those love to topple the trees.
They love chewing on willows.
Yeah, it's not like they eat them. They just, I think, like to see them fall. So, you know, that's some more stuff that now is coming back to trying to do revegetation work down there to reestablish some of those.
Do you think the adaptive management process, this commitment to multi-stakeholder, multi-agency, collaborative decision-making, is a good institution for trying to figure these things out? Like, what desired future conditions do we want? What resources should we prioritize? Is it, on the one hand, some people might say it's too complex and messy and democratic and inefficient, and on the other hand, other people might say, no, we don't want, you know, one agency or one powerful interest to be able to dominate decision making. We need a level playing field, and we need people to talk to each other and develop relationships. Where do you stand on that process and its ability to actually solve these longer term, deeper problems about figuring out what it is that we want and how to manage to try to get those things?
I mean, I think it's one of the better approaches for just avoiding lots of litigation, for trying to manage resources. Mm. It's been, I think, its success has been mixed in this program. And this, from what I understand, is one of the better programs at doing it. And for a number of reasons. As far as developing some of the conditions that are desired, I don't think adaptive management is necessarily the best way to do that. I think it's a good way to try to balance some of the issues, and I think direct research and some of those sort of things. But I think in this situation, it's led to some problems, and I think it's given, in a way, stakeholders a belief that they have more power maybe than they do. And I say that for a number of different reasons. One thing is, I'm not sure if we've effectively done adaptive management in the way it was kind of originally conceived. This program was beginning right during when adaptive management was kind of still an academic sort of exercise and looking at ways to do that type of management. And so, you know, some of the early meetings we have, who is his name? Kylie, I think, is one of the people who is an early,
right, Kylie from the Pacific
right,
Northwest,
proponent,
right, And Carl Walters.
And Carl Walters coming in and giving talks.
We interviewed him last month.
Yeah. And so one of the things that happened is when the record of decision occurred and we put a series of changes into effect, it was not clear what the scope of the adaptive management was to operate on. Hmm. Some people, you know, in a traditional EIS, you come out with something you're going to do, and then you go ahead and do it. Mm-hmm. The flows that were put in place, I think, were viewed as being pretty conservative. And so the question then became is, with the monitoring and research, was that to guide whether the flow, other parameters could be expanded, or was that the limiting box in adaptive management only tweak things inside,
inside
of
the box?
And that I don't think was ever agreed upon. Mm. I mean, my thought initially was adaptive management was to change the size of the box, as we learned, because we had taken a pretty conservative approach to the flows and the restrictions, and it might be that we could expand them or do different things as we learn more. A lot of people said, no, the box is the box. You can do whatever you want within it, but to go outside of that required a new EIS. And so, you know, in that sense, it wasn't clear whether tweaking things within the box is adaptive management or not. Certainly it was adaptively managing the research that was going on, those kind of things, and as new things, inputs to the system came in, we changed the kind of research, what needed done. So I think the collaborative approach was certainly the best way to try to manage that kind of thing, look at priorities, look at those sort of things. But as far as the actual management, I don't know whether that's the best. And then to get back to the broader question of, is it the way to manage the system? One of the things when we started was the park really didn't have a good general management plan for what they wanted as land manager for many of the resources down there. Mm-hmm. And so that gave the stakeholders, I think, this perception that they could develop a lot of these resource goals instead of the park, which has led to some issues too.
The Park Service probably felt that was stepping on their toes.
And so, but because a lot of these resources didn't have anything explicit, that's where we got into the DFCs and all that kind of stuff. Had there been very explicit
DFCs?
Desired future conditions.
Oh, gotcha. Thanks.
Yeah. So, had the park had really explicit conditions that they were managing for all these resources, I think it would have limited some of that more management, I guess, feeling that the stakeholders felt they should be able to do. It would have been driven by more of, this is what's there, are we meeting it? You know, you look at the hydropower, I mean, people aren't getting in there and saying, no, WAPA should change your contracting this way to do contracts, or, you know, those kind of things.
Right.
They're not telling the Fish and Wildlife what they should be writing for their biological opinion, but they are saying what a lot of the park resources should be. So, you know, in that sense, I don't think adaptive management is the best way to manage for an individual agency's thing. I think they need to take the lead and what those priorities are, and then use the adaptive management to look at how that's being achieved, ways of better meeting those goals.
Interesting.
So I think it's a mixed thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one thing if it's true co-management, you know, and the tribes, that's one of the things the tribes have been arguing for, because the Western management goals and tribal for the same resources are so often disparate about how they approach it, that without a true co-management sort of approach, one side or the other is the one that makes the decision, and so the other side feels they're being shorted on it if it's a different decision. You know, it's a power issue,
right?
Ultimately.
Right. Reflect a little bit on the power dynamics in the adaptive management program in the 28 years that you were involved. Who have been the more powerful, influential players, and why, and what's the outcome of that?
Well, certainly, I mean, the Bureau of Reclamation is obviously the principal driver.
Because
they operate the dam. It's their program. I mean, most of the so much of the program is driven by the compliance needs of the Bureau of Reclamation for endangered species and, to a lesser extent, cultural resources. Those are the first things that tend to get met through the science. That's what needs to be done.
Okay.
And is essentially the coordinating agency for everything. You know, they can sort of lead by developing agendas and those kind of things. And, you know, certainly during the original EIS, you found out pretty quickly that whoever got whatever language down first on paper for everyone to comment on, the first straw man, that tends to direct kind of where you
set
go.
The agenda. Yeah.
You know, and the Bureau of Reclamation, I mean, you know, it is their program in a large sense, so it makes sense that they would drive things. You know, power, I think, you know, is one of the stronger stakeholders. But I think, you know, by and large, all the stakeholders have been pretty well incorporated into the process. You know, they don't always get their way, certainly. Mm-hmm. But I think they've all been heard. You know, the environmental groups were always at the table, and you know, I think they were the first ones who felt that their needs weren't being met when Grand Canyon Trust pulled out and had a lawsuit.
When was that?
Must have been in the late 90s. I'm trying to remember.
So after the Record of Decision.
Yeah.
And they had been involved throughout the environmental studies period.
Yeah.
And through the EIS and the ROD, and then they pulled out a few years later?
Yeah, they felt that it was probably not appropriate for them to be involved in litigation and sitting on the committee. You know.
Yeah.
So, but
they decided they might get more of what they wanted through an adversarial relationship than participating as a collaborative.
Yeah, I guess they felt that, you know, their collaboration wasn't getting to where they wanted it to be.
We're going to try to do an interview with somebody from Grand Canyon Trust to get that perspective.
Yeah, Rick Johnson would be a good one.
Yeah.
Or Nikolai.
Or who?
Nikolai. What's his name? Think of it in a second. It was Nikolai Lash, but he changed his name. Ramsey. Or maybe it went from Ramsey to Lash. But either of them. Rick Johnson.
Yeah, Rick's on my list.
Okay. I think one of the groups that has been surprisingly powerful behind the scenes in a way, and possibly because it's sort of a coalition, is the fishing, the recreational fishery.
Uh-huh.
You know, they tend to be pretty vocal. I mean, they get their position out. But it's been one of those, and Arizona Game and Fish obviously
allied.
Is very supportive and allied of the trout fishery. But it's been one of those, from a logical standpoint, that just never makes sense. You know, in one sense, trout are being blamed as the bane to the humpback chub, and yet there's no way they'll get rid of the trout fishery up there. You know, it's just one of those things where, if you look at it, it's like, why are you trying to maintain a trout fishery at one part of the river?
Mm-hmm.
There's no barriers between that part and the part with the endangered fish that's being managed almost diametrically opposed. And so it's just like, you know, and it's an artificial fishery. You know, they're non-native fish. It was put there as a trout fishery, as a management choice, through most of the Grand Canyon. They're trying to remove trout, non-native fish. But yet, we have this one place where we're going to insist that they remain. And everyone involved in, you know, whether it's Fish and Wildlife, Game and Fish, or the trout fishermen, you know, it's like, yes, this is a given. This is going to be here. And, you know, it's just one of those weird situations where it's a little schizophrenic looking. But everyone kind of lives with it. But clearly there's some power somewhere in there.
Have you seen shifts in, you know, a number of people like you have talked about how some of the stakeholders ally together. When we interviewed Lee Kwan Wasiuma, he was talking about a tribal caucus, how the tribe's representatives often meet the day before AMWIC meets and sort of go over the issues.
Right.
What other interest groups? You just mentioned one, the commercial and recreation, on the recreational fishery, not commercial fishery.
Yeah.
What other sort of caucuses have developed, and how has their participation changed over time, or relationships between caucuses changed over time in your mind?
Well, certainly, I mean, there's some longstanding, I guess, informal groups that tend to ally together. You know, certainly Park Service, tribes, environmental groups tended to come in sort of in the same, the whitewater rafting. Those were all kind of allied together. Generally, the basin states were together, and often with the power interests. You know, one, this is a little tangent, but one of the things that I think has been successful in this program, and I think allowed people to try to do things cooperatively, is it's always been somewhat of a consensus program. And so as we were moving along, it got more and more into kind of a caucus kind of situation because of voting. Decisions were being done by voting, and so it became trying to line up people on your side of issues so you had the votes, rather than to try to come to an agreement on an issue and compromise. And we got going down that path of voting, and that's when the Department of Interior agencies kind of pulled out and said, no, we shouldn't be voting members if we're going down that road. And luckily, with the Ann Castle era, we went back to doing things by consensus, if at all possible. And so it got rid of that need to caucus and get groups together and form coalitions to try to outvote the other side, which I think has been really beneficial, because I think it has allowed the groups to be, to essentially not stake out territory and not give on it, and allowed people to, you know, is the voting thing when it's like, well, if we're not going to win, why even go to the meeting? You know, that kind of perception. The other kind of caucusing, which isn't really caucusing, but the before, like, the AMWIC meetings, the DOI has their own meetings, so that, again, they were trying to get all the DOI agencies sort of on the same page.
DOI,
for the
Department of Interior.
Department of Interior. Because, again, one of the things I thought was always nice to see, but Department of Interior wasn't so keen on it, apparently, was often different Department of Interior agencies didn't see things eye to eye. And I always enjoyed the discussions to see why they didn't agree on things. You know, Fish and Wildlife might, may or may not see things the same way as the Park Service, who almost definitely didn't see things the way Bureau of Reclamation did. But those discussions, I thought, were always interesting. but I guess they decided it wasn't appropriate to air the dirty laundry in a public forum. So the Department of Interior started having meetings before AMWIG to make sure they were kind of all on the same page. And since they weren't voting, it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. During the era of voting, you could have, again, Park Service, Fish and Wildlife might get together with the tribes as a group, mm-hmm. whereas Bureau of Reclamation might go with Western Area Power or something as a group, and so they'd be voting against each other, which was always kind of weird. But
what were the dates in which you feel it was more based on consensus, and then what was the date range in which it went to caucuses and voting and blocks, and then
I don't know if there were any dates for it actually to, I mean, there was always a voting ability during TWIG and AMWIG, but it seemed like it got more and more formal probably during the early 2000s. I don't know. It just kind of slowly crept in until it got to the point where all of a sudden the vote became more important than the issue, in a sense. And I don't remember the exact date. Is when Anne Castle was the secretary's designee that we really formally tried to go back to consensus, you know. And I'm sure that Mary Orton probably has the exact date when that got passed. But the operating procedures, I think, tried to make it a consensus process, which I think is good. And again, you know, this is an advisory committee, so.
Right, ultimately,
what was happening,
it just makes recommendations to the Secretary of Interior, right?
And so what was happening is you'd end up with a split vote, so you'd have the majority, and then you'd have a minority report also written.
Right.
So it just, in a way, didn't make sense because the same discussions were contained within the record anyway. And at least with Anne Castle, she was very involved in the process, took a large interest in it, and so she could report those discussions back to the secretary, too.
Right.
And so everyone was being heard anyway. You know, and it may be when that voting process was getting more and more formal that may have been when Grand Canyon Trust pulled out, too, because, you know, if you end up on the losing side of the vote too long, it makes sense rather than writing a minority position, just have your lawyer write that position instead.
Right.
You know, so. But yeah, I mean, I think going back to a consensus makes it much more collegial, and I think we can talk the issues out a lot better than when it didn't matter. You just lined up your votes and went for it.
Hmm. Interesting. Any particular events that happened during your time involved that you thought were sort of marked a significant change in the way people approach things or the issues that were addressed?
Well, I think certainly the shift to decide we needed to do high flows was, you know, wasn't a huge change in, I think, thought process, but I think just, you know, as far as actual an adaptive management sort of thing, that was really the first kind of big experiment in that we're going to go outside of the normal operations of the dam and do something specific, have a lot of science and monitoring to understand if it was doing what we thought it might be doing, mm-hmm. and to track the outcome of it. You know, there were some other experiments similar to that. You know, the low steady flows and some of those to address some of the other earlier questions about what might be best for the native fish.
Were those experiments implemented or just talked about?
No, they were implemented. What was it, the low...
Seasonally adjusted low steady flow or something.
I'm trying to remember what that called. LSSF. Low steady. Low seasonal steady flow. Something, I don't know. Too many acronyms.
Yeah.
Can't keep up with all of them. What other things? I mean, a lot of things tended to be somewhat incremental. Which is probably good in an adaptive management program.
Sure.
You know, I think certainly the recognition that there's an awful lot of outside influences too, to do the whole thing as just a formal experiment, which again I think is looking at some of the adaptive management, it's recognizing you can't control all the inputs to the experiment. That some stuff you just have to, it's an ongoing experiment and you just got to monitor it. I think probably one of the biggest changes is just the shift that we're seeing to a native fishery down there, and unfortunately not knowing 100% why that's happening. You know, I think that's something that's going to be a focus probably the next 10 years or so. The other thing that I think is kind of an interesting unknown is why we still have a native fishery at all. Because in most other places where you have as big a sources of non-natives all around the system, you know, they immediately get replaced. The non-natives take over fast. When this program was kind of early on, the Yampa River was primarily a native fish river, and it just went overnight. I mean, it's now non-native, and it happened fast. Why the LCR persists as a refugia, in a sense, for humpback chub and hasn't been invaded, given that it's warm water. There's bass around, there's other warm water non-natives, but they've just never gotten a foothold. The same with most of the river. I mean, there's been lots of other non-natives in there, but they've just never completely replaced the native species. So, you know, that's one of those big questions, I think. And certainly it's a focus of concern for going into the future. That's why the park's doing a non-native aquatic species EA, is to figure out what to do when something shows up that is going to spread rapidly.
Yeah. That reminds me that one of the reasons that people like Carl Walters and Kylie came up with the science of adaptive management is the recognition of uncertainty. And climate change is another one of those things that we know it's happening, but we're uncertain about, you know, what the effects exactly the effects are going to be. And that recognition of the tremendous uncertainty of ecological responses to, you know, to a dam or to climate change, is the rationale for coming up with this idea of adaptive management. Do you think, how do you think the Glen Canyon Dam Adaptive Management Program has done in recognizing, embracing, and dealing with uncertainty?
I think it certainly recognizes it. And, you know, it's, I think a lot of the science, either explicitly or implicitly, recognizes it, it's there. But I think we still try to address the system too much in, I guess, a traditional Western scientific approach. And it's, you know, I think one of the, it's probably a human nature issue, but, you know, the scientists working on things want to address research that they actually live to see the end of and can write up. And so even though, you know, some of the stuff hopefully will be long term and maybe we can't answer it for 20 years, a lot of the research still has to be 2 to 5 year sort of time frames. And, you know, this is an area that I think the tribal involvement, I think, has been one of the, they've been incorporated, involved better than in a lot of programs. But on the other hand, I think they fundamentally look at the system in a way that would be helpful for the Western scientists to look at it. And it's getting, again, into that uncertainty sort of area. I mean, the tribes have the time depth that their traditional knowledge is seeing climate change. You know, how it's recorded, how well it's recorded in oral history or other tribal knowledge is, you know, hard to say. And the integration of that into Western science is poor, not just here, but anywhere. It's not something that's easy to do. But it also, I think, kind of underpins the tribal view of a more hands-off approach, because they're looking at that long time depth and things change. We can't foresee everything that's going to happen.
Can't control it.
And so, you know, going back to like the rainbow trout, the tribes basically said, you know, you shouldn't be going in there and trying to kill them all off. It's not their fault they're there. You put them there. They're a living entity in the system. Furthermore, they seem to be coexisting with the chub. They may be somewhat limiting, but they haven't wiped them out. And it's better to let nature do what nature does, which in a sense, you know, I think is them recognizing that people can't control everything. And I think that is born of that really long time depth in a very environmentally changeable area. I mean, yeah, in the last 100 years it's not done a lot of things, but in the last 2,000 years it has. You know, we had the whole drought in the 12,000s or 1200s and stuff. You know, so some of that I think just gets into their overall philosophy of land management. And so I think they view the more active management that Western land managers want to do as being too much. And so that's kind of a roundabout way of saying that, you know, the uncertainty, I think we try to control more of it than we actually can, and especially when we get into decadal time periods or longer, and certainly climate change is operating over that. You know, you look at the changes in what's going on in the riparian system, we may still be just seeing the ripple effect from the fact there's a dam there, not by the daily changes in what the operations are. You know, it may be 50, 60 years before you get some kind of equilibrium of what that downstream riparian habitat looks like with a dam upstream. You know, and so there is some of that, I think, that the traditional tribal knowledge could be used for adaptive management to recognize what the limitations are.
Let's. I'd like to get some advice from you of additional people that you think we ought to consider interviewing. You mentioned Rick Johnson with the Grand Canyon
right.
Trust, but who else? I'm going to make sure nobody falls through the cracks. It would be really important.
You know, I'm sure Ted Mellis has been.
He's been
mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he was involved a lot early. You probably talked to Dave Garrett and some
yes.
of those people. Trying to think whether some of the other directors of GCMRC.
Jack Schmidt, we talked to.
Jack Schmidt, mm-hmm. yeah, he was in town yesterday, 2 days ago.
Yeah?
Yeah. Who else? Clayton Palmer, you probably have on your list.
I'm not sure. Who
He's
is
with
he?
Western Area Power.
Okay, yeah. We need to interview somebody from WAPA.
Yeah. He'd be a good one. Randy Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
Probably have.
He's on the list.
Let's see.
How about tribal reps?
You have Kurt, I'm sure. Dungowski.
We talked to Kurt last month. That was
okay.
a good interview.
Let's see, Loretta Jackson.
She's now on the list. We talked to Carrie Christensen, and we're going to try to get Loretta.
Okay. Maybe Clay Bravo.
That's a new name.
Clay Bravo or Don Bay or both together.
Don Bray?
Bay, B-A-Y. They're both with Wallapai, or were during the original EIS.
So they were around at the beginning.
Yeah.
Like your time frame, too.
Who other people? Alan Downer. He was Navajo.
Yeah, Lee Kuanwasima mentioned him earlier. How do you spell his last name?
D-O-W-N-E-R. And I believe he's still the Hawaii Shippo. Shippo.
In Hawaii?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we cracked a joke about going to Hawaii to interview him. but he worked for the Hopi Cultural Preservation
Office. No, he was
with
Navajo.
Navajo, okay.
Historic Preservation Department. He basically started it and was involved. Maybe Richard Begay, if you want early stuff. Again, he did all the early work for Navajo, the ethnographic work and stuff. Him and Alexa Roberts.
Alexa Roberts?
Yeah. She's with Park Service or just retired.
And they did work for the Navajo
Did the Navajo ethnographic work at the same time period. A bunch of these people kind of all left when the adaptive management program started. They were involved in the lead up to it, the development of the EIS, and then moved on.
How about documents, important documents that were produced that we want to make sure are highlighted in the administrative history?
I don't know if there's anything specifically that wouldn't be just kind of the general
record of decision.
All the documents I can think of are things that were never completed. They're the things that keep getting revisited, the hard issues, essentially. Right. So, there's been various iterations of core monitoring plans to try to develop something that's just, try to change every year, that just a long-term core monitoring. There's been plans that are looking at desired future conditions in one way or another, those kind of management things. But none of them are ever completed because those are the hard issues that not everyone can agree to, or they're agreed to at such a high level that they don't necessarily get you where you need to go.
When was the first round of efforts to identify desired future conditions? Do you remember a time frame?
Probably in the original EIS, okay. Is my guess. We're trying to figure out what resources should look like. Certainly there were lots of discussions that went on both in the drafting of the EIS but among the cooperating agencies about what, is there a time period we're targeting? Is it a pre-dam thing? Is it something else that we don't have now? So there were things like, the beaches after 1996, we should target that as the area, things like that. But I don't think there was ever truly anything agreed to of what that should be.
Any other hard issues? You mentioned that twice. There are hard issues that just have to keep coming back. You've got long-term core monitoring plans you mentioned and desired future conditions you mentioned.
Yeah.
Anything else that is sort of perennially cycles back around because it doesn't get resolved?
Well, in and out of the program, what is the scope of the program? I think that's a little more detailed from the current LTAMP, since the LTAMP is now the program, that rod. But still, with different resources, what is that boundary? For cultural, it's varied, and it depends on what kind of cultural resource. It's kind of flexible. But that's been a long-term issue. Funding.
I was just writing that down.
there's never enough.
How about representation? There doesn't seem to have been much controversy over who are the stakeholders. And
yeah, I mean, it's a pretty broad scope. I mean, we haven't heard of any groups wanting to come in, really. And, you know, some of that's laid out in the Grand Canyon Protection Act. It's not clear necessarily how some of the identified stakeholders select who should represent them, you know, primarily within the environmental and recreation interests. You know, it's the environmental groups have been different at different times. Mm-hmm. Recreation, there's been some trout fishing, and the Grand Canyon River guides have been the whole time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, how that's decided, I don't know.
But that hasn't been controversial.
It doesn't seem like it has been. I mean,
doesn't seem like it.
Yeah.
In my interviews, anyway.
Yeah, I've not really heard much either inside or outside about that being too much of an issue. I thought of one other. What was it? The inside outside of the. Oh, I guess just what. What the role of the program is in relation to whether it's a recovery program for endangered species versus just a monitoring, you know, reporting sort of program. Because, you know, a lot of the stuff that we do ties into some of the what would potentially be recovery goals. But some of the commitments are outside of the scope of the program. Things with refugia, doing stuff, you know, with potential spills in the LCR, some of the other things that are identified. And so, you know, while a huge amount of the funding goes to monitoring and even doing stuff for the chubs, like translocation and stuff, we can't do everything that's identified, and it isn't a recovery program, you know, and so it isn't clear. I mean, if 90% of our funding goes to fish, well, would it make more sense to just say, okay, it's a recovery program for the chub, now your scope is to be able to do everything that's identified to meet that, you know.
But would you recommend that? Would you like that outcome?
At one time, I thought it would almost make sense to separate out a program that could be adequately funded to do just that, and have this program essentially address all the other resources that don't have a law that you have to comply with, which might get you more towards the broader environment and management of it, because, you know, the ESA stuff and cultural, there's a lot of it they got to do whether this program exists or not. And so that might be a way to focus more emphasis on some of these other resources down there.
It's remarkable to Jen and I how many people acknowledge that the adaptive management program has essentially been, for its entire stretch, about fish and sand. And which is a little surprising to me that those have become so overwhelming in influence and focus. You know, it's only been 20-some years, 25 years. What do you think the next 10 or 20 years, what's going to be the fish and sand, or added to the fish and sand in the next 10 or 20 years, or ought to be added as a big emphasis?
Yeah. Well, actually, it reminded me of a couple other things that are both long-standing issues, but I think may be relevant for the next however long, is fish and sand. Two things that have repeatedly come up are some kind of sediment augmentation and temperature control device. And they're big ticket things, but, you know, I think one of the things we're seeing now with the fish and how well the natives are doing is a temperature issue, particularly in the Western Canyon. It's a double-edged sword. Initially, when temperature control was discussed, it was for raising temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Now we may be going into a situation where we may want to cool the temperature,
right,
because we may be creating finally that habitat, the warm water non-natives, mm-hmm. They can flee out of Lake Mead and come upstream and mm-hmm. do well. So that's one that's been on the table for a long time, and I think could become a bigger issue in the future. And
go ahead.
Then the other one is sediment mm-hmm. and sediment augmentation. Again, that was early looked at as trying to get lots of sand in the river for beaches, that kind of thing. More recently, it's been looked at as turbidity. Turbidity, again, is a fish management tool, mm-hmm. making the water more turbid to try to prevent non-natives coming in.
Because that favors the native fish because they evolved in turbid water.
Yeah, and, again, the two principal players in the non-natives are the two trouts, brown and rainbow, mm-hmm. and turbidity definitely disadvantages rainbows and potentially browns, and so that was looked at as one way, but at least for cultural resources, to do anything with erosion, you need something more than just making the water muddy. You have to have a lot of sediment,
uh-huh.
Slurry pipelines, whatever. Uh-huh. So that's another one that I think may come back around in the future, is something that we need to look at. And it may tie in with the stuff going on down in the Wallapai area with having too much sediment down there. We need a pipeline to circulate it back up.
Push it back up.
Since the Black Mesa pipeline is no longer in use, if we can run it over there and run it back upstream.
That's right, there is a slurry pipeline going down to that coal-fired power plant that's now closed.
Yeah.
Well,
still in the ground, most places.
Yeah. I had heard that the Navajo and perhaps Hopi were interested in using that pipeline to get water from the Colorado River up to the two reservations. I don't know if it would even be functional, but somebody is thinking about that.
Yeah, they've looked at pipelines. It'd be probably cheaper to do a new one from Lake Powell,
right.
Which has been studied. Bureau of Reclamation's looked at that multiple times, or just downstream from Lake Powell, depending on which basin adjudication it gets. Because
right.
For Hopi, it would all be lower basin.
Yeah.
Navajo has some upper,
basin.
And so Hopi, technically, we couldn't take it out of Lake Powell. You got to wait until it gets below Lee's Ferry before we can take it, But.
Or they could buy or trade water with the Navajos. There's all kinds of marketing options.
Yeah.
You ever think about how climate change may shift the emphasis of the program in the future? Or cause it to adapt?
Well, certainly. We're already looking a little more seriously, I think, at putting generators on the bypass tubes. That was a suggestion long ago for when you want to have high flows so that you don't get the penalty for bypassing the turbines and the power generation. Huh. You put turbines on the bypass tubes. But with lower lake levels, they're foreseeing a future where you may not be able to get water out the normal generators,
mm-hmm.
and the only way to get them through is going to be through the bypass tubes.
Uh-huh.
And once you get below that, then it's just a dead pool, so it doesn't matter. So climate change, I think, is driving that a little bit. Certainly it's changed sort of, it's driven how the water is allocated now between the two lakes. And what that's meant is actually in a lot of these lower water years, we've seen higher flows down the river, which is a little counterintuitive, but
moving
it's to balance
water from
the
Lake
reservoir.
Powell to Lake Mead.
So even though when we're getting what in the past would be a normal minimum release year out of Lake Powell, now they're higher than minimum release just because they got to get water to Mead
mm-hmm.
to equalize. And what that's going to do if we hit a shortage and stuff.
If or when?
Or when, yeah. 2020, apparently.
Yeah, that's what they're saying.
Yeah, you know, and it changes the runoff. I don't know if it's it could potentially change the frequency that high flows could be triggered, but may also just, in a broader sense, change sediment input, because we tend to get more of the bigger storms that have short-term high sediment runoff. And, you know, what that'll do to sediment balance stuff, I don't know.
Do you anticipate there'll be any obvious potential impacts to cultural resources from climate change?
In, you know, if we're getting more frequent heavy storms, you get the catastrophic loss of archaeological sites. I mean, what's driving it down there is rainfall. I mean, it's the rain that washes it out. And in the past, you had new sediment coming in to replenish it. So unless the entire site went, it's usually one arroyo that starts eroding things, and that refills somehow through time. And that isn't happening as much. But if you're getting more intense storms, you have a better chance of catastrophic loss, it seems like. Just coming off the river this time, there were some places that were pretty impressively hit in the last few weeks down there. Go on YouTube and look at a flash flood down at Fern Glen.
I saw that last week.
Yeah, we went by there, and you can just see where it's come off, all the slopes there. I mean, rain.
That was pretty muddy water coming off, too.
Yeah, well, and it was just debris coming off the canyon sides in places that in the past you just rarely saw that much rain all at once in one spot. I mean, it runs off, you get the normal pour overs and stuff. This just whole slope areas were coming off. Every little rivulet had debris coming out into the canyon. So it's pretty impressive to see some of that.
And that's unusual, and you expect to see a lot more of that in a warmer world.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they were saying, based on the radar images, they're estimating, 5 inches in 20 minutes or something ridiculous?
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, we had 5 inches out at Doney Park in 2 hours earlier this year. But yeah, 5 inches in 20 minutes is a little scary. I don't know if that's an overestimate or not, based on just the radar stuff they were looking at, but, you know, much more than an inch or 2 an hour is pretty unusual.
Yeah.
So.
One of my last questions now, do you have any advice for new people who will be coming onto the Adaptive Management Program? I heard you're going to be retiring in about a year, similar to me.
Less than a year.
You've got
the end of this year.
Yeah, wow. So you've got to be thinking about who's going to come next. And if you had an opportunity to sit down with your replacement, what kinds of things would you say to this person?
Well, certainly I think, you know, to try to come in recognizing that there's a lot of different expertise in the program, and that, you know, to try to learn from all the people involved and keep a cooperative sort of atmosphere, I think, is a big key to the program. You know, it's definitely a steep learning curve. The more you can apprentice with someone, the better. But yeah, I think mostly just coming in with the intent of trying to make it work, I think, is a big key. Because I think that is one of the things that's made this program somewhat unusual, is everyone is willing to listen to each other and learn from each other, and at least broadly manage for kind of the similar goals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's always heartening to see when everyone in the program agrees that the program should continue when the funding gets cut, when they see that on the horizon and no one's going, no, let's get rid of it, it's been a detriment or something. So I think, you know, that would be one key. And then, you know, and I think that then allows people to try to learn from a bunch of different players to come up to speed on what's going on. You know, the program has also been good in that there hasn't been a lot of turnover. I mean, people involved tend to stay 3-5 plus years. You know, obviously there's a few of us outliers. But actually, up until 5 or 6 years ago, a lot of the people involved were predated the EIS, you know, and are still at least peripherally involved. So, you know, try to learn from those people who know some of the legacy of the program, because, yeah, there's just so much knowledge in science. There's no way you can just walk in and go, okay, I know everything about this program. You know, so much comes in on a daily basis. And just, it seems like Linda's sending out a new report once a week or something.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't know if Linda Wetton's on your list there, but she should be too.
How long has she been involved in the program?
Probably since the late 90s at least.
Really? Okay.
I think I'm trying to remember when she first came in.
I thought she was, you know, recent staff. But if she's been around that long,
yeah,
we need to talk to her.
Yeah. No, she'd be a good one to talk to, I think. You know, certainly from administering the program and all the behind the scenes and all of that.
Yeah, that would be a good perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Mary Orton was probably the only person we've interviewed so far who's almost entirely focused on the administration of the program,
right,
and the relationship building and consensus building and sort of that aspect. Most
right
of the people we talk to are, you know, either scientists or policymakers or stakeholders.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a valuable perspective.
Yeah. No, she's been around definitely for a long time, basically doing the meeting notes and setting up the meetings and coordinating everything and all of that.
Well.
So, yeah, she'd be good. But no, and I, you know, for certainly from a tribal perspective, you know, I think whoever would be coming in needs to be interested in kind of the whole range of the tribe's involvement from doing, you know, the on-the-ground science and monitoring up through the being at the meetings and the management and that kind of thing. You know, because certainly one of the things I've been able to benefit from is seeing that whole range of stuff. You know, a lot of people, they're just at the AMWIG meetings or else they're just in the canyon doing research. But for the tribes, because we're usually fairly limited on both staff and expertise, you end up kind of becoming a jack of all trades and doing it all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know an awful lot more about fish than I ever
expected.
I would. Yeah, it's funny because
your training's in anthropology, right?
Yeah, I'm an archaeologist. Yeah, and I, you know, Kurt and I had worked together just for contract archaeology companies in Phoenix. We both went up to work for the Navajo tribe like a few months apart, and then Kurt got hired at Hopi and then hired me a few months later to start the Grand Canyon stuff. And I think the first two meetings I went to, one was a technical kind of review on fish, and I'm sitting in there going, what am I doing? And then the next one was on non-use economic valuation down at ASU, where they were talking to all the people at the forefront of doing that kind of work, which was really controversial and not used at the time. That would have been 91.
That's, you know, pretty early.
Talking about, you know, how much would people pay to not cut down a tree and those kind of things.
Right.
And so I came back from those meetings kind of going, I have no clue what I got into. What is this? But, you know, certainly in hindsight, just being exposed to all the different stuff, I think, was really valuable for tribal members. I think it'd be a good way. And certainly, you know, for the tribe, it'd be great to get tribal members more involved in representing the tribe. You know, part of it was just by default that there's very few tribal archaeologists or Hopi archaeologists out there. It's not a profession Hopis go into because there's been very few positive role models in anthropology and archaeology, so not something they want to do. But we've got a couple now. There's some definitely moving up.
I imagine all of those annual river trips that each tribe takes, especially the Hopis, mm-hmm. is a great way of introducing the next generation of young people to the canyon and to these issues. And you're training your replacements,
hopefully.
It sounds like.
Yeah, well, sort of, but not entirely. I mean, for Hopi, it's been a little bit unique just because for Hopi, the Grand Canyon, you know, it's the origin point and lots of other history, migrations and stuff, but it's where they go in the afterlife. And so it's actually fairly taboo to go down there. And you're supposed to be fully initiated Hopi male to go into the canyon. And so for a long time, we didn't have very many young people at all going down there. We haven't taken women into the canyon. And there's a lot of people, or not a lot, but a number of people in our office, including one of the Hopi archaeologists, who for cultural reasons just won't go down there. And so it's been a little tricky finding a replacement because a lot of the Hopis, for cultural reasons, won't go into the canyon. They'll do the outer stuff. But yeah, just going into the canyon has been something that we're going to have to find the right person.
Yeah, Lee Kwanwasiuma was telling us that of the 30 years he's been involved in the program, he's probably only gone down the river maybe 7 or 8 times.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his explanation, that you're not really supposed to do that very
right.
often. It's a very special, sacred
yeah.
place.
Yeah, I mean, traditionally, it's only the initiated people who'd go down there, and only for certain reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the salt pilgrimage was mm-hmm. part of the initiation ceremony. Mm-hmm. And so you were led by a person who was initiated. And now that ceremony doesn't really occur at Third Mesa, which is where they mostly went over there.
Mm-hmm.
So theoretically, no one's supposed to be down there.
The salt pilgrimage isn't, nobody does it anymore?
Not in the sense that it was in the
uh-huh.
past. There's still Hopis who have done it to collect and things.
Mm-hmm.
And at Second Mesa, the initiation still occurs.
Mm-hmm.
But they go to Zuni Salt Lake as much as they go into the canyon.
Uh-huh.
One of the people that we worked with early on was one of the last initiated people from Third Mesa. And so he was able to go down with us, both for the research, but for him it was completing what needed to be done for the initiation too, to go to the salt mine and up to Sipapuni. And so, you know, some of that was carrying on, some of it. But through time, you know, obviously traditions change in cultures, and there's a recognition that the knowledge about the place needs to be carried forward, but it may not be done in the same way as it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as we've shifted from research to more monitoring down in the canyon too, we don't need necessarily the people who are the, you know, the higher level ritual knowledge and those kind of things down there, because we're just getting the people's impression of whether it's being cared for appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we get more of a mix now of some of the younger people on the river, but yeah, finding someone to do it as a profession mm-hmm. has been tricky.
Well, I wish you the best of luck in that, and I hope that the program continues. Everybody we've talked to has emphasized how valuable it is and mm-hmm. what an honor it's been to be involved, and it sounds like you feel the same way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, this certainly, you know, if it wasn't a valuable program, so many people wouldn't have been involved for so long
right.
and fighting to make sure it goes on, because it is important. I mean, it's producing a lot of information. For the tribes, it's been really important because it's allowed them to have a much larger say in management in general, but in specific about a place that's so culturally important to them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a way, you know, whether mention colonialism somewhere in his discussion, but he probably did. But in a way, it's allowing the tribes to have access back to the land that they were displaced from and have some role in the management of it going into the future, which is good. You know, it helps them keep their own knowledge and traditions alive, even if it's through a different way of doing it. You know, we do surveys during our monitoring, and one of the consistent things that they say is that, you know, going into the canyon, doing the trips, and being involved is very important for them and their culture. So there's certainly buy-in among the tribal members too. It's like something they want to see go forward.
Well, I think that's a great place to end the interview.